Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 690, Update on the Meltdown, Part 5, Who and What was Roland Arnall? This program is being recorded on September 20th of the year 2009. We're going to plunge right back in. If you missed the discussion in Side 1, well, go back and get it, because it's essential. We're taking a look at Roland Arnall, whom I believe to be what I call a Bormann Jew, one of the Jewish operatives of the post-war Nazi Bormann Capital Network, the dominant economic force in the world, along with the Japanese underground economic empire. We've been taking a look at Roland Arnall. Now, is Roland Arnall and his AmeriQuest and Argent companies that were basically at the epicenter of the subprime operations, and it was the subprime crisis that basically brought the whole thing down a year ago. Now, how much is known about Roland Arnall? Again, this is the guy who more than any other individual was responsible for it. What I really think is that it was the people behind him, because look what came out of the subprime crisis. It completely beggared the United States. It beggared individuals. It beggared financial institutions. It did a tremendous amount of harm to the United States and many of its institutions. It has indebted America for a long, long time to come. We also wind up making a lot of payments to a lot of the companies that benefited from this. The bottom line, folks, the bottom line is you. You are the ones, the taxpayers, who picked up the tab. But this is the guy who more than any other individual was responsible, Roland Arnall. Ever heard about him? I'm going to reiterate, this is all that is known about him for sure, from the book Chain of Blame by Paul Muolo and Matthew Padilla, I'm not sure how he pronounces his name. Only one thing seems certain about Roland Arnall's early years, that he was born in 1939 in Europe. His family was Jewish, which meant their lives were in danger as Hitler came to power and Nazi Germany expanded its borders by invading other nations. His official bio has him born in Paris on the eve of World War II. An unconfirmed press report says that it was Poland. Arnall has never given any type of extensive interview about his past or about anything else, for that matter. To avoid detection by the Nazis, the family said they were Catholic, according to one attorney who did business with Arnall. That's all that's known about this guy, and that, folks, is what is known in professional circles as omitted information. Again, the secretiveness characteristic of Bormann operatives and the Bormann network, as we've looked at, uses Jews. There are also people who are actually Nazis using forged Jewish documentation. Now, about Roland Arnall, AmeriQuest, and Argent's central places in the subprime business, reviewing more information from Side 1 and developing further, even though Arnall, again from the book Chain of Blame, even though Arnall was out of the business by 2007, he, as well as the Jednaks, had left behind a family tree of executives and loan officers who had worked at one of his companies and then decided to either start their own subprime shop or work for an existing one, taking along with them the tricks of the trade. Not all of those tricks, good tricks. In a way, Arnall had served as the Johnny Appleseed of the subprime industry. Jack Mayesh, Arnall's right-hand man at Long Beach Mortgage, stayed out of the business for 3 years after the company was sold to Washington Mutual and then reemerged with a brand-new lender called Residential Mortgage Assistance Enterprise, or RESME for short. Note how it sounds like Fannie Mae. It was based in Brea, nestled in the foothills of North Orange County, 20 miles from the Pacific. Its specialty, to no one's surprise, was subprime lending. Mayesh's backers on Wall Street, Lehman Brothers, and Greenwich Capital, by the way, Greenwich Capital of UBS, which promised to lend him money and either buy or securitize his loans. Joining Mayesh in his new venture were two other former executives who had worked for Arnall, Edward Resendez and William Comperda. In its first year of operation, RESME funded $1 billion in loans, a phenomenal sum for a company that a year earlier didn't even exist. Well-connected, eh? Says Dave, parenthetically. Continuing, another former Arnall acolyte at Long Beach Mortgage was Stephen Holder, who went on to help start New Century Financial Corporation, a non-bank that eventually supplanted AmeriQuest Argent as the largest subprime funder in the United States. Holder eventually left New Century and formed yet another company, Encore Credit, which Bear Stearns backed. Also out of Long Beach came Frank Curry, who formed Acoustic Home Loans. LBM alumni Pat Rank and Bob Derbysh opened Option 1 Mortgage, which eventually was sold to Fleet Bank of Boston and then to H&R Block, the tax preparation giant. In time, Option 1 became a top five-ranked subprime originator. Arnall employee Tim Walsh launched the retail arm of First NLC Financial Services of Deerfield Beach, Florida. Eventually, more than 100 AmeriQuest employees, including several top sales managers and loan officers, would join him. So again, when we're talking about Roland Arnall, AmeriQuest, and Argent, they are the epicenter of subprime, and subprime is the reason all this stuff went down. More about their huge PR and advertising campaign, and also about the various institutions which they backed, ranging everything from the Texas Rangers Stadium, the land sale for which helped to enrich George W. Bush, turning once again to Chain of Blame. This is about AmeriQuest, along with Argent, Roland Arnall's main operations. The idea was to brand the AmeriQuest name on anything that would give the company maximum exposure and make its telephones ring. As Cole had noted, it was all about selling. Over the years, AmeriQuest bought the naming rights to the Texas Rangers baseball stadium and advertised on the walls of major and minor league stadiums, both major and minor league stadiums. It sponsored a tour by the Rolling Stones, and even topped that by hiring Sir Paul McCartney to play the halftime show at the Super Bowl, the AmeriQuest name emblazoned over the TV screen as the former Beatle finished Live and Let Die. Argent, even though it didn't deal directly with the public but through loan brokers, sponsored NASCAR race drivers such as Dario Franchitti and Danica Patrick, the Argent name printed proudly on their cars and uniforms. It sponsored athletes far and wide, Jim Furyk, Chris DeMarco of golf, Michael Phelps, and Amanda Beard, the U.S. Olympic team, among others. Terry Rauch, who worked for several of Arnall's mortgage companies over the years, noted that AmeriQuest's and Argent's names were truly everywhere, unquote, saying the company's plan was to create instant name recognition, quote, not to just brokers and borrowers, but literally to the world, and with all 50 state attorney generals, unquote. The mention of the AGs by Rauch was a joke, but that's exactly what happened. AmeriQuest Argent was nothing short of a mortgage juggernaut. Not only was it the largest subprime lender in the nation, but it now ranks 10th among all residential leaders. The industry knew it, Mozillow knew it, investment bankers knew it. Managing directors from Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, and Friedman Billings Ramsey had all knocked on Arnall's door to try to convince him to take the company public through an initial public offering. Year after year, he resisted, but then in late 2004, he began to think otherwise. Around this time, both the press and several attorney general's offices, California, Connecticut, Iowa, and New York among them, began paying attention to a growing pile of allegations at the company, against the company, that some of AmeriQuest's retail loan officers were a little bit too high pressure on the sales tactics, convincing homeowners to take out loans they couldn't afford. It was also around this time that Arnall's retail production chief, the man in charge of all the loan officers on the street, Kirk Langs, announced his retirement. Langs was just 40 years old. The company, true to form, said little about the retirement. Rumors began to circulate in the industry that the Langs might have walked away with a retirement package worth $17 million. He, like Roland Arnall, his boss, wasn't one to give interviews. And still more now, as things are starting to go south, and it's worth taking a look at the timeline here. And again, note that this is the guy, basically, who, at least nominally, and I think really, from an analytic standpoint, one would have to say it was the forces for whom he fronted that basically produced what you saw last year and what is it bedeviling all of us. But this is the guy, Roland Arnall. Ever heard of him? That little bit of non-bio, which is the best way of putting it, that's all that is known about the guy. That's plenty bloody damned little. More from Chain of Blame about how things began to go south for AmeriQuest and Argent and Arnall. And remember, though, the passage that we just read, it was Arnall, AmeriQuest, and Argent that were sort of the breeding grounds for those who basically carried the whole subprime situation forward. They described him as the Johnny Appleseed of subprime. Returning again to Chain of Blame, rumors were swirling around about Arnall's AmeriQuest being the subject of predatory lending investigations in multiple states. The last thing in the world the market liked was an investigation about a mortgage firm's lending practices, even if it was an aberration. And it was doubly bad that the rumors concerned the nation's largest subprime lender, AmeriQuest. Now, as the cracks are beginning to appear in the edifice here, and also, as I've noted, it was in the middle, early and middle part of this decade that the investigative spotlight, so to speak, was being turned on the Bush family Nazi connections, and a lot of those went through the Netherlands. In For the Records 361, 370, and 435, particularly in 370, we went into the Bank for Handel and Scheepvaart, which along with the Thyssen Bank and the Union Banking Corporation, headed up by Prescott Bush Sr., were the main banks that the Thyssen operation had set up to avoid appropriation after World War I and then later after World War II. When the president of the Bank for Handel and Scheepvaart found out that his Netherlands bank was actually a front for Nazi money laundering, he went to New York to talk directly to its parent company, the Union Bank, and its president, Prescott Bush Sr. He died of an apparent heart attack under very strange circumstances a short time after that. That is to say, the president of the Bank for Handel and Scheepvaart, not Prescott Bush Sr. Again, For the Record 370 goes into those Dutch connections at great length. So do 361 and 435. And the declassified documents proving the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II can be examined, the actual documents, in a linked URL to the WestSpitfireList.com website. Now, as things were beginning to go south here for Arnall, as the first cracks were beginning to appear, and as journalists were starting to focus on the Bush family Nazi connection, some of those going to the Netherlands, Roland Arnall, that mysterious individual at the epicenter of the subprime and financial crisis, about whom nothing effectively is known for sure, was appointed by George W. Bush to be the U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands, where he would not only be out of the United States, but in a position to monitor anything that was going on vis-a-vis an investigation of the Bush family Nazi/Bormann links running in the direction of the Netherlands. Turning now, again, to Chain of Blame by Paul Muolo and Matthew Padilla, or Padilla. Wall Street firms had made well over $100 million in fees from AmeriQuest, Argent, and affiliated lenders over the years by lending them money and securitizing their subprime loans, but the biggest payday of them all, underwriting fees from an IPO, likely would never materialize. Word of several state attorney general investigations concerning its lending practices had killed that hope. In late July, this is 2005, in late July, the Bush White House made it official. Arnall was being considered for the ambassadorship to the Netherlands. This time, AmeriQuest spokesman Chris Orlando finally decided to say something, quote, "Mr. Arnall would be willing and honored to serve his country in any way he might be asked," unquote. Even though Arnall and his wife had made large donations to the Democratic National Committee over the years, all eight Democrats on the Foreign Relations Committee, which had first vote on ambassadorships, said they would vote no because of the abusive lending allegations hanging over the company. Republicans were inclined to vote yes. Republican Senator Norm Coleman from Minnesota said of Arnall, quote, "His personal actions had never been called into question," unquote. In January 2006, after several more months of rumors about what the Attorney General's offices were up to, AmeriQuest made it official, agreeing to pay 49 states $325 million to settle charges that it engaged in abusive lending practices. Virginia was excluded from the settlement because AmeriQuest didn't lend there. It was the second largest home lending settlement in U.S. history. Roughly 750,000 loans that AmeriQuest had made to its boiler room-trained loan officers were affected by the settlement. On average, each AmeriQuest customer would get $600. One of the most damaging charges against the company was that its loan officers had engaged in a practice called upselling, where the loan officer was compensated extra money to originate mortgages at a higher note rate or more points. In settling, the company admitted no wrongdoing and boasted to the press that the settlement with the states in no way restricted its ability to lend. The deal also cleared the way for Arnall's ambassadorship to go through, though the vote was narrow. Shortly thereafter, his wife Dawn was named chairman of ACC, the holding company that oversaw Ameriquest and Argent. Argent, the wholesale arm that used brokers, wasn't part of the settlement, though Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller told reporters that the states would begin investigating wholesalers and brokers. And more about how this began to play out once things began going south, turning again to Chain of Blame by Paul Muolo and Matthew Padilla. Wall Street firm after firm would announce they were writing down by billions of dollars the value of subprime CDOs they held on their balance sheet. CDO, by the way, collateralized debt obligation. Well, beginning again, Wall Street firm after firm would announce that they were writing down by billions of dollars the value of subprime CDOs they held on their balance sheets. The numbers were getting huge. Citigroup, $11 billion with potential exposure on CDOs and structured investment vehicles of $45 billion. Union Bank of Switzerland, UBS, a major warehouse lender to subprime banks and an investor in CDOs, $10 billion in write-downs. Merrill Lynch, $8.4 billion. Bear Stearns, $1.2 billion. HSBC, the London bank that had bought subprime giant Household Finance earlier in the decade, was taking a $3.4 billion loss on subprime loans it held. These were markdowns on their value, not necessarily net losses. The reason they were being marked down? Subprime delinquencies. And then, as the crisis began to really develop, what happened to Roland Arnall? He came down with and died of a apparently fast-acting case of cancer. Now, a couple of notes. The guy was 70. People do die of cancer, but as veteran listeners to this program know, first of all, cancer can be used as an assassination weapon. Freedom of Information Act documents that have been declassified have revealed that as early as 1954, the CIA had perfected a means of using cancer as an assassination weapon. In the years that the various simian cancer-causing viruses have been researched and almost certainly weaponized, those techniques have grown more sophisticated. So cancer can be used as an assassination weapon. There have even been a couple of murder convictions where people were convicted of murdering someone using cancer. Also, veteran listeners to this program know that when these various investigations begin to unfold and when they get sensitive, a lot of times some of the people who are most sensitive buy out. And just as the whole financial collapse was really beginning to gather steam or momentum, Roland Arnall dies of cancer. Turning again to Chain of Blame. Adam Bass of Ameriquest Capital Corporation, Arnall's holding company, now winding down what was left of its assets after the sale of Argent and Ameriquest servicing business to Citigroup, was in attendance. The only reporter there was Lou Sichelman, the nationally syndicated housing columnist. Sichelman dined with Bass during the conference. A few weeks later, Arnall died of cancer in Los Angeles after having resigned his ambassadorship to the Netherlands. He had come back to the United States from Europe to be with a seriously ill son who was also battling cancer. The intensely private man had never let on publicly that he too was sick. True to form, he had done his best to live under the radar. And more about the death, the very timely death of the very secretive Roland Arnall. Again, when the first cracks in the financial edifice were beginning to appear, and when journalists were taking a look at the Bush family Nazi connections, a lot of which go to the Netherlands, Roland Arnall is appointed by George Bush to be U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands, thereby out of the country and in a position to manage any investigations going in the direction of Bank for Handel and Schaefart or any of those related companies. And then, when the whole thing is really coming down, Roland Arnall is no more. The highly secretive Roland Arnall dies of a very conveniently timed case of cancer. Of the death of Roland Arnall and his funeral, the authors Muolo and Padilla write as follows. In the world of subprime collateralized debt obligations, it was all about transferring risk from the mortgage lender into an ABS into a CDO. the fool was the last one holding the bond. Some of these fools were headquartered overseas in faraway lands. Others were foreign banks or investment banking firms that had set up shop in New York City to lend money to non-bank subprime lenders, securitize their mortgages, create tranches, package them into CDOs, and send them across the Atlantic. Some were unlucky enough not to find investors for their CDOs, which meant they held them in their own investment accounts. Germany's Deutsche Bank, parenthetically a Bormann bank, Switzerland's UBS Securities, parenthetically a Bormann bank, and Royal Bank of Scotland's Greenwich Capital was Royal Bank of Scotland, not UBS, were all major players in the U.S. subprime market. In April of 2008, UBS took a $19 billion write-down on its subprime business, which included securities that had fallen in value and were now worth a fraction of their original worth. 2 weeks before UBS unveiled its huge loss, AmeriQuest founder Roland Arnall died of cancer and was buried in Griffith Park in Los Angeles. Terry Rauch, who used to work for Arnall as an account executive, was in attendance, as were family, friends, and other employees, and politicians far and wide, including Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, former Governor Gray Davis, and current California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, the retired movie star. During the entire ceremony and procession, Schwarzenegger stood near Rauch, who with his sunglasses and athletic build blended in with the governor's security detail. "Arnold put his hand on my shoulder a few times," remembered Rauch. "He thought I was one of his bodyguards," unquote. Rauch didn't recall anything being said at the funeral about AmeriQuest. It was obvious to him that it was neither the time nor the place. The focus, as it should have been, was on Arnall's achievements as a humanitarian, his work with the Simon Wiesenthal Center. Quote, "It felt like a political rally where the amount of politicians coming to pay their respects," unquote, said Rauch. "It was a touching Jewish ceremony. You could say there wasn't a dry eye in the place, but it wasn't necessarily for the passing of the father of subprime. It was for our own futures," unquote. Well, again, note the people in attendance, chiefly here Governor Schwarzenegger. Note that these banks, Deutsche Bank, UBS, they have been recipients of bailout money. And who, folks, is underwriting all of this in the end? You and I, the taxpayers, are the one who are picking up the tab. And it has done tremendous harm, not only to America's economic present, individual Americans, but to the individual and collective economic future of this country and its citizens. It has been a huge blow. And the size of the damage has really been kept relatively quiet. Perhaps in another update on the meltdown, some of the real scary numbers involved here will be gone into. But bearing in mind Citicorp, which got a big bailout, and bearing in mind UBS, we talked about those in For the Record 688 and again in our conversation with Peggy and Sterling Seagraves. Those banks have billions and billions and billions of dollars in stolen World War II gold, some of the Golden Lily loot sitting in their vaults. It's Black Eagle Trust / Golden Lily loot, billions upon billions of dollars. When we were talking about the heirs of Santa Romana trying to get their hands on that gold, it was described as $50 billion in Citicorp's vaults. That was decades ago, folks. That's a whole lot more than that right now. But doesn't matter. In the end, we wind up picking up the tabs. Going to talk briefly here about Lee Harvey Madoff, although it was not directly connected to the financial meltdown on Wall Street. At the same time, the collapse of what turned out to be a Ponzi scheme, the Madoff Fund, not only helped to further cast a big chill on the investment climate, but also a lot of people started, there was actually a fair amount of internet rap, so to speak, about, yeah, you see, it's the Jews responsible for the financial meltdown. It's one of the reasons why the Bormann Group uses Jews. One of the things to pay attention to vis-a-vis the Madoff operation, as I've called him in the past, Lee Harvey Madoff. No sooner did he get busted, he said, "Nope, I'm the only one. There's nobody else involved." And well, since then, his chief financial officer, Frank DiPasquale from New Jersey, has been indicted. Very interesting, the story really with regard to the Madoff operation are the feeder funds that channeled basically money into the Madoff operation. Also, where has the money gone? The vast bulk of this money has disappeared. Offshore, folks, into the dark vaults I spoke about a couple of programs ago in 688. Who knows where the money went, but the key element vis-a-vis the Madoff operations are the feeder funds. Now, in previous discussions of Lee Harvey Madoff, I've discussed Mr. de Viache, who was investing, a member of the French elite, who was investing European money in the Madoff operation. He was found dead near the end of last year, an alleged suicide. He supposedly took a bunch of sleeping pills and then slashed his wrists with box cutters, although one of the cuts was on his biceps. Now, I've never committed suicide via sleeping pills and box cutters, but that's a hell of a miss, folks, and I suspect that it was not actually suicide. I suspect he was suicided, but the French elite is controlled by the Bormann Capital Network, as is the European elite. One of the other major feeder funds was Fairfield Greenwich Group, headed up by a guy named Walter Knoll. And it was the Fairfield Greenwich Group of Walter Knoll, by the way, a good friend of John J. McCloy III, that was one of the major feeder funds. In a nutshell, we're going to go quickly. This is an article from Vanity Fair's issue of April of 2009, article by Vicky Ward, Greenwich Mean Time, about Knoll. And when one examines the Knoll operation, Fairfield Greenwich Group, the evidence suggests very strongly that this, too, was a Bormann operation. For openers, Fairfield Greenwich Group was sometimes steered to its client by Monica Knoll, that's Walter Knoll's wife, by Monica Knoll's cousins. Half Swiss, half Brazilian, she was a member of the prominent Hagler family. Her cousin Jorge Paulo Lehmann is Brazil's richest financier and co-owns InBev, Budweiser's parent company. That, by the way, that company, InBev, is a major investor in beverages of all kinds, including alcoholic beverages. The Hagler family are very, very interesting. I'd like to put out a request to listeners to send me what they can find about the Hagler family. They are of Swiss extraction, allegedly, according to internet postings, involved in the arms business. During World War II, they moved from Switzerland to Brazil. Very interesting. More about Fairfield Greenwich Group. Skipping down. As Fairfield Greenwich expanded, the most prominent of its salesmen came to be Knoll's own sons-in-law, whose European and South American backgrounds were invaluable to the firm. As things stand, Walter Knoll owns 17% of FGG's business, as does Tucker, who, like Knoll, semi-retired 2 years ago. Fairfield Greenwich Group's chief shareholder is Andres Piedrahita, who owns 22%. Piedrahita, 50, is a short, brash Colombian married to Knoll's eldest daughter, Karina, 45. The other Knoll sons-in-law have also reaped riches from FGG, and all but one of them worked for the firm as well. Yanko Della Schiava, 44, an Italian married to Knoll's second daughter, Lucina, 44, sold FGG in northern Italy and southern Switzerland. Knoll's fourth daughter, Alex, 41, is often called the earthiest of the sisters and is married to Swiss-born Philip Tube, 43. Knoll put him to work selling Fairfield Greenwich mostly in Brazil, where the Tubes moved, before returning to Greenwich with their children. The family's baby, as she is often called, Marissa, married a dashing New York hedge fund manager, Matt Brown, 39. Only the third Noel daughter, Ariana, 42, chose a husband who decided not to work for FGG. He, by the way, is an Italian, and they live in London. I'm going to put this in the description for the show, but again, a knowledgeable observer looking at the Fairfield Greenwich Group feeder fund and all of their connections to Europe, particularly the Latin parts of Europe and Switzerland and Latin America, would say, sounds like Bormann Capital to me. But that wraps up For the Record Program 690, Side 2. Update on the meltdown, part 5. Who and what was Roland Arnall? This has been recorded on September 20th of 2009. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.